Welcome to Cracking and Fracking, Standard & Poor's monthly corporate ratings podcast with your host, me, Thomas Waters, Managing Director and Sector Lead for the U.S. oil and gas and chemicals industry. Our podcast will tackle credit trends, ratings and outlooks in the oil and gas and chemical space, as well as insightful analysis on industry trends and market dynamics. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Cracking and Fracking. In today's session, we're going to focus on IMO 2020. So on January 1st of next year, the International Maritime Organization, IMO, is set to enact some regulations on the shipping industry, and that's going to limit sulfur emissions. And we believe this is going to have broad implications for the oil and gas, the refining, and the shipping industries, of course. Dialing in today is Rachel Garish. She's based out of our London office, and she's a sector lead for the materials, construction, and transportation sectors. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Also dialing in with us is Mike Grande, who is a sector lead for the midstream and downstream sectors. Welcome, Mike.
How you doing, Tom?
Doing good, thanks. So before we begin with questions for our guests, maybe just a quick high-level overview would be helpful here. You might be asking, what exactly are these rules targeting? Well, as I mentioned, they're going to target sulfur emissions from marine ship vessels. And what they're looking to do is reduce the emissions from the current 3.5% to 0.5%. Now, according to the IMO, ships account for about roughly 13% of global sulfur dioxide emissions, which, as you know, has been implicated in acid rain and obviously for some health concerns. The regulation will impact maybe roughly about 4% of total oil demand and has the potential to be one of the most disruptive changes to ever affect the shipping and the refining industries. Now, upon implementation, shippers that have not installed scrubbers to remove sulfur can meet these requirements by replacing the residual, what we call high sulfur fuel oil, with cleaner alternatives such as diesel or marine gas oil, and maybe some sulfur blends of gas oil and residuals. The residual fuel oil is the product that remains after the higher value-added products such as diesel and naphtha, kerosene, et cetera, are distilled away in the refining process. Many refiners, though, who lack the capacity to refine and upgrade the fuel oil into these low-sulfur products have sold this high-sulfur fuel oil into the marine fuel or the bunker market, and that gets blended with the distillates to create various grades of fuel oil. Now, according to the EIA, Energy Information Agency in the U.S., total residual fuel represented about 8 to 9% of total demand for oil and products, which is about maybe 7 to 8 million barrels per day. Now, of that amount, it's estimated that global high sulfur fuel oil ship bunker demand in 18 reached maybe roughly about 3.5 million barrels. So with that as an overview, maybe we'll turn to you, Rachel, for a couple of questions on what you think the impact is going to be on the shipping industry. So how do you think most shipping companies will meet these stricter low-sulfur requirements?
Well, thanks, Tom. Yeah, we think most companies will actually meet the requirements by using low-sulfur bunker oil or cleaner alternative fuels. However, prices for these compliant fuels are expected to remain high. Although, you know, we do think the price differentiation may reduce over time. So, stability of earnings for companies operating in this highly cyclical industry, and ultimately survival of some players, particularly for the smaller players, will depend on their ability to pass through these increased fuel costs to their customers. And we think spot operators and container liners are typically, they bear the highest fuel risk. But larger industry players that we rate, such as Maersk, CMA, CGM, and Hapag-Lloyd, we think they'll have the most success in passing these increased costs on, because they have better bargaining power with their customers and they already have protective pricing mechanisms in their contracts. So they have bunker fuel adjustment factors in their contracts already, and we expect these to largely cover the fuel cost increase, although we expect a time lag of probably about 3 months to pass the higher costs through. And as such, we will be looking carefully at liquidity profiles, because they must be strong enough to cover this extra working capital need, albeit only a temporary for a couple of months. But we think smaller players perhaps players that we don't rate may well struggle with this extra liquidity need, and also if they lack the bargaining power to pass on the higher fuel price costs. So then they may, you know, might find it difficult to continue to operate.
Okay, interesting. What about these scrubbers? I mean, hearing an awful lot of talk about them. Are they expensive? Can most shipping companies afford them? And I guess maybe has there been much uptake in scrubber installations?
So that's the other option, you know, to invest in these exhaust gas cleaning systems, so, you know, typically known as scrubbers. And they are quite costly, so Platts estimate between $2 and $6 million for each one. And then obviously the ships are taken out of use for, you know, anything from kind of a month to a couple of months whilst these are being fitted. And if there's no guarantee that, you know, even more strict regulations might come in, and then, you know, perhaps the scrubbers, you know, there's no guarantee that they will continue to meet further regulatory requirements. So there's actually been less of an uptake than we thought. So I think the latest estimate is about 10% of the global maritime fleet are expected to have these scrubbers by the end of 2020. So I think overall, we expect more companies to go for the low sulfur fuel option overall.
Okay, great. So I guess the next question and the big question is, how's this regulation going to affect the ratings on our shipping companies?
So overall, we rate 15 shipping companies globally, but these vary from LNG shipping and passenger ferry companies, which we assess as at the lesser risky kind of end of the scale, to container liners, like I've mentioned, and dry bulk shipping companies, which we assess as the most risky. And given that two-thirds of these 15 companies that we rate globally are rated in the single B category or lower, so, you know, fairly low end of the rating spectrum, any material added costs or added capital spending in scrubbers that can't be recovered could potentially have an adverse effect on ratings. However, we do believe that industry-wide freight rate increases will be inevitable in the short term. But the entire industry is similarly adversely affected by the new emission limits, and it will be in all players' interests and the whole industry's interest to recover this cost inflation. So we think that, you know, overall, we are likely to see higher shipping rates and cost recovery or deals with customers to share any capital investments from scrubbers.
Okay, Rachel, thank you. Mike, maybe we'll turn to you a little bit, maybe what's going on the refining side of things.
Sure.
It's clear that refineries are going to be scrambling to change up their product mix and oil slate. I guess maybe taking a high-level view, like how's IMO going to affect refineries globally? Like, on which countries, you know, stand to benefit? A lot will depend on complexity, obviously.
Yeah, that's right, Tom. I was going to say it depends on the complexity of the refinery. You know, basically, the more complex the refiner is, the easier it is for it to process the cheaper, kind of heavier crudes into higher value products like gasoline, distillates, diesels, and jet fuels. Basically, what we think is that the U.S. stands to benefit the most, as they have the most complex refiners in the world with an average Nelson complexity index of about 10. What that means is, if you think about the distillation unit for a refinery, that's a score of 1. So a 10 is a very complex asset. Refiners located in, say, Africa, South America, Russia, some European and Asian countries have a lot lower complexity scores, which means they don't have the ability to upgrade these heavier discounted crudes into the higher value products. And they have limited kind of coking and hydrocracking ability, and yield more low-value products like fuel oil. So they'd most likely have to switch to lighter, sweeter crudes, which will be more expensive in order to kind of process and refine things into products, and they'll feel it the most.
You know, there's a lot of different options refineries can do, but what can they do? I mean, you know, how can refineries adopt these upcoming changes?
Sure. So you're right. There are things they can do. What we expect to happen is that refiners will most likely tweak their crude slates rather than dedicate large amounts of capital to kind of upgrade their assets, because one, that's very expensive. And two, we think that the IMO is really a temporary kind of benefit to refining margins and product margins. And by the time they would even think about upgrading, the opportunity would be gone. For refineries that are less complex in other parts of the world, they'd likely, like I said, switch to more lighter, sweeter crudes, such as Brent or Louisiana light sweet crudes, and that would tend to increase their supply of lower value products into the market, such as asphalt, which can probably depress product prices.
And Mike, maybe as a follow-up, how has this affected pricing?
The less complex refiners will find this is probably their only choice to produce more low-sulfur fuel oil, and that would probably drive up the demand and prices for the light sweet crudes and distillates. So, you know, that there's some other things they can do, like less complex refiners can also sell excess high-sulfur fuel oil as a coker feedstock to the more complex refineries, enabling them to reduce purchases of the heavy sour crudes.
And Mike, the same question I gave for Rachel. This is the big question. What will be the implication for the ratings on the refineries?
Sure, Tom. So globally, we rate approximately 20 refiners globally. There's at least half of them are in the U.S. I could probably start with the U.S. because they're the refiners that probably stand to benefit the most from this. The way we approach our ratings for refining is, you know, we rate through the cycle. It's a highly volatile sector. Even though refiners will likely benefit significantly in 2020 in terms of increased cash flow from margins, even if it's temporary for a few quarters, we don't expect a lot of ratings movement. Refiners tend to keep a lot of cash on the balance sheet, and typically what they've done when they get a windfall of cash from a good quarter or two is they'll return it to shareholders, and we expect that trend to continue. So share buybacks, possibly increased dividends, although we think that it'll probably more go to a share buyback for investors since it's a discretionary use of funds, and you know, leverage should be pretty low, and I think that, you know, in general, ratings will not move. Globally, for refiners that are struggling a little bit more, you might see some pressure on margins and cash flow. But again, typically these ratings have already factored in that volatility, and I don't expect a lot of movement, as this shouldn't be a prolonged commodity in cycle.
Terrific, Mike. Thanks for the perspective. Maybe a little perspective from the upstream oil producer side of things. Initially, we believe that IMO will cause a broad increase in oil prices, all else equal. Refinery utilizations are going to go up a few percentage points. So this will obviously put some upward pressure on global crude prices. But not, it's nominal. It's only maybe, we're only expecting maybe $3 to $4. So we don't really expect much of an impact on that regard. But one thing that is certain for many crude grades that vary in sulfur and viscosity is that we do expect heavy sour, light sweet differentials to widen. Obviously, the heavier crudes tend to have high sulfur content and yield a greater proportion of high sulfur fuel oil. Some of the highest sulfur crudes, such as Western Canadian Select and Mexico's Maya, and a lot of the Middle Eastern crudes, well, we see some of them, the prices declining. On the flip side, the North Sea and WTI crude is definitely going to benefit. All in all, though, we don't see price increases as long-lasting or sufficient to warrant whole-scale ratings improvements.
The decline in heavy crude realizations should be more meaningful, but again, just not long enough to warrant any rating downgrades.
Well, that concludes today's episode of Cracking and Fracking. I want to thank Rachel and Mike for joining today and providing their perspective. And thank you all for listening to this podcast.
If you have any comments or thoughts on today's topics or future topics that you would like to learn more about, send me an email to thomas.waters@spglobal.com. Thanks for listening to Cracking and Fracking, our U.S. corporate ratings podcast. I'm Tom Waters. See you next time.